Welcome to Season 14 of the Art of Teaching podcast. I'm Matthew Green and I'm so grateful that you've joined me today. Before we get started with our discussion, I would like to acknowledge the Dharawal people, the traditional custodians of this land on which I'm recording, and pay respect to elders past, present and emerging. I acknowledge the stories, traditions and living cultures of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples on this land. Today I'm excited to share a recent conversation that I had with Phil Murdoch. He's a specialist design teacher and an experienced voice in AI and education. On a more personal note, he is the father of three and is about to be a grandfather for the first time, and he'll shortly be celebrating his 30th wedding anniversary to his high school sweetheart. In our chat, we talked about being a parent, embracing failure, and the future of schooling. I hope that you get as much out of this wide-ranging conversation as I did. Please enjoy. Phil Murdoch, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for talking with me today. Where are you phoning in from?
I'm calling in from Upper Coomera on the northern Gold Coast up in Queensland.
Fantastic. And quite possibly the most important question for our conversation, what's your coffee order for when I can finally jet up to Gold Coast?
Super simple, small flat white.
Nice, nice. And is there a book that you have read recently that has caused you to kind of stop and reconsider a few things?
Not recently. Being just teaching, I tend to read a lot more journal articles and snippets. I'm reading a book by Leon Furs at the moment called Practical AI Strategies, Engaging with Generative AI in Education.
Amazing. Shout out to Leon. I also got a copy of his book today. I think that's from the wonderful people at Amber Press. It's a great book. I had the privilege of reading a copy of it before it was published. And it's a really great book. And congratulations to Leon. Are there any sort of takeaways from that you'd like to share so far?
The biggest thing is I've been sort of an avid user since it was released in the end of November 22, but some of the implications more for me is looking at the ethical side of things. Is Leon's opened up just a few things that I hadn't even thought about with some ethical implications, not so much about its energy consumption or anything like that, but some of the stuff in relation to who's actually doing a lot of these data entry points and some of the sustainability things with that. So yeah, it's opened my eyes to a few things, and as a design teacher, sustainability is a key thing. So
yeah, and I'm sure we'll get into all the amazing work that you're doing around AI and design a little later. And before we do that, what are you most grateful for from your upbringing?
The ability to have freedom. Like my parents are great. They've instilled a faith in me, but they allowed me to travel that journey. But they also allowed me the freedom to be me and make mistakes. Just the ability to allow just me to explore my own personal views and things like that. So, and being the middle child, you're always looking for attention. So,
and how do you think that, Phil, has sort of shaped the way that you approach parenting? You mentioned before we hit record that you're a proud dad, but how has that informed your approach to how you raise your kids?
I've taken I guess the best that from my memories of how I was raised, and there were some things that, you know, as all parents, and I know I've been, you talk to my kids, they'll tell me I did things wrong, or could have done things better. And so there was things that I noticed growing up that I thought, I'm not going to do that with my children. But I think it doesn't matter where you were raised. If you've got your love for your children, and you've got their best interests, and you want them to succeed in whatever avenue, you'll just do what you can to make that happen.
Yeah.
Regardless of your upbringing. So
interesting. Phil, tell me about your tattoos. What's your favorite tattoo?
Oh, I've got quite a few. All my tattoos have meanings. I've never got one. There's no drunken tattoo stories on this side of the recording. They all have personal meaning.
Right.
Some about my faith journey. Most represent a country that I've visited, from Thailand to various parts of Italy and Paris. And I love art, so I've got a number of pieces of art that I've just was captivated by in some galleries around. You know, one of them on my calf that you can't see. We're in the Met in New York.
Yeah.
And we're just wondering, are we blessed to be able to take the family away? And I saw this sculpture and it just captivated me. And like, I literally for 20 minutes just walked around in circles around this item. The rest of the family, they're off. But yeah, it just the creativity speaks to me in various forms, and it's a very visceral thing. So
can I ask what the sculpture was of?
It's from Boccioni. It's a futuristic piece. A futurist piece. He was an artist in the 1930s, and he actually didn't see the piece cast in bronze. He made the mold, but spoke to some of his colleagues, and they said no one will ever like it. So he just put the mold to the back of his studio, and it wasn't until he died that they were actually produced. So there's that story of unrealized potential there as well. So
yeah, do you think that is, did you feel an affinity towards that? Could you somehow relate to that that philosophy around that piece? I mean, you mentioned that art speaks to you and speaks to us all in different ways, but was there something about that really resonated with you?
It's hard to, I mean, you talk to a lot of people when they're talking about art. It's just something that almost can't be put into words. It's just that feeling that speaks to you. I mean, prior to teaching, I'm a toolmaker, so a precision metal machinist. So to see the work that went into making this bronze sculpture, you know, seeing the craftsmanship behind it and the skill and the technique to actually get that there, yeah, it's that I just had a complete attraction to it without being able to explain it.
It's really interesting, and I'm sure that sort of sentiment will thread through our conversation this evening, because I think it touches on some really interesting things, like you said, the craftsmanship, the idea of creating an art, and also this idea of the future and what is in many ways we're unable to understand what the future holds, and I think there's some really interesting points in there. But before we get lost in the moment, can you tell me a little bit about your history and education? Like, how did you get to where you are today? And there's a saying that it's hard to join the dots looking forward, but when you turn around and look back, it all kind of makes sense. Do you subscribe to that sentiment, or yeah, how did you get to where you are today?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've heard another thing. So, you know, your windscreen's a lot bigger than your rearview mirror.
Yeah.
But you need to see where you were to get to where you're going. But yeah, definitely. I think I said earlier, I'm in the middle of five children. I've got two older brothers, a younger brother, and a younger sister. But I was, you know, I really enjoyed primary school. I think that was fun. And, you know, and then I got to high school, and, you know, the boy monster started to come out. And high school was sort of, I like to say, a social experiment for me. I had fun with my mates playing sport, but I wasn't captivated. I look now and again, looking in the back, I went from, essentially failing high school. I got my TER, and at that point it was anything below 15 or below was just 15 or below. So I could have got 15, I could have got one, who knows. But I went from that and a very low level math in high school to mechanical engineering trade, and where I'm, working at complex physics, trigonometry, turning moments, and all this engineering stuff that I got almost instantaneously, because there was meaning attached to it. So I think at school I was predominantly bored and not engaged. I think education's changed a lot since then, but I had a bunch of fun at school, and it was always like, yep, I'm just going to be a tradesman, be a toolmaker, blue collar all the way. But then I got through that, and I'm working in, I worked in an amazing tool room and was taught by some exceptional men. But then I you need to step out, you need to grow in your industry. And I moved into a couple of factories, and I was working in one particular factory in research and development. And I'm watching all these older gentlemen, I'll say gentlemen, I'll be polite. And they didn't want to come to work. They didn't want to go home. They just wanted to come to Thursday, which was payday, so they could get their money, go to the pub, have some beers, and have a gamble. And I was just like, man, I'm not turning into that. I don't want to turn into that. I had, I had my firstborn child at that point. And I'm just like, there's got to be bigger. There's got to be more than this. And I mean, I was good at my job, but it was just like, there's got to be more. I talked to a few people, and it was like, what do I want to do? And it was looking at, maybe I'm too cynical to be a police officer. I was talking to some friends in the ambulance service, and they said, look, it's great, but again, you've got a young family and you have to become cold when you go to work. The problem is that bleeds back into your home life. So I thought, I don't want to do that. And my brother-in-law said, oh, there's a new degree that's just started at the university he was at. It's a design and technology thing. Why don't you be great at it? So a number of phone calls and emails and a whole range of things. And I finally got accepted, just because it was so late in the game. I finally got accepted in, and it was under the guise of, I'll do that, but I'm going to do teaching. But I didn't want to limit myself. So it was either 3-year education degree or 4 years doing a design degree and a bachelor of teaching. So I thought, I'm going to be in it for 3 or 4 years, so I'll get 2 degrees out of it.
Phil, there's so much in that. I mean, you covered a lot of ground, and I know we haven't even talked about your teaching degree. Sorry, your teaching career after that. But there's a couple of things I'd just love to pick up if that's okay. And you talked about in school, like something changed. And what was that? Was that did you have a great teacher? Did you have something that you're interested in? Was there what changed? Because you went from someone that respectfully wasn't doing very well at all at school to then going on to do mechanical engineering and tool building and working on some really complex projects. So what changed?
Engagement and value being placed. Like, I had some great teachers in high school, don't get me wrong, but I also had, and again, these are my memories, and maybe it wasn't the case, but definitely as a teenage boy, that's how I felt. But there were definitely some teachers who didn't like me, who couldn't understand me, who couldn't understand our behavior, our reactions. So it's, and I think that step out from high school to industry was, hold on, you're here to work. We trust you to do a job. and we're going to give you what you need. If you got a problem, ask for help. And we're going to show you, tell you, sometimes not always in the nicest words, but it was there for the betterment of you and the business, and to make you a better person and employee.
Mm.
Whereas I think in school it was just, and I went to a fundamentalist Christian school, so it was very rigid, and you know, if rules weren't followed, they didn't understand that someone's trying to explore the world that they're in. I don't think so. I had a few teachers who allowed that, who really allowed a few of us to explore that. There were definitely boundaries and repercussions, but they understood what we were doing.
And then what about the, you talked about some of the men that mentored you in the tool room. What were some of the things that they did to mentor you in such an effective kind of way? Because this was outside of your, obviously outside of your school. So I'm sure it's a whole new world where you're in industry. You're mixing with all different types of people. But what was it that these mentors or these sort of role models did to help encourage and inspire you to really push yourself?
It was all about getting the job done, and getting a job done quickly, effectively, and with quality craftsmanship. So like with tool making, you know, we're looking at precision machining, you know, we're working down to microns. So it's, yeah, highly precise, and so you can't afford to make a mistake. And if you do, you need to know how to fix it quickly. And so they, you know, they taught me, you know, how to do things. They showed me, they explained it, they allowed me to make mistakes, but only to a point. So I could ruin a certain amount of material, but they would see where it was going to be beyond salvageable, and they'd stop me before I got to that point and go, no, stop. This is what you're doing wrong. This is how you need to fix it. And this will get it done.
It's interesting. I mean, there's so much in that in terms of like how we build these cultures of trust and how we build these cultures of accountability, but also allow people to make mistakes within the safety of that sort of structure. I mean, there's a whole lot in there, and I would love to one episode in the podcast talk to somebody about how we actually encourage young people to move into trades, because I think when I went to high school, I didn't even know that there was another option other than university. And so like, I would love to, I've got a number of close friends that are builders and tradespeople. I'd love to have more of a conversation about how we encourage young people to move into that space, because it seems like there's so many people that would be sitting in classrooms that are bored for whatever reason, and they don't realize that there are other options out there. I mean, would you agree with that? Like, do you think that I'm sure when you were sitting in school, you weren't even aware that this was an option to be able to go and get a trade and all this stuff.
Yeah, it was, you had to finish school, you had to get through, and yeah, you know, I mean, I come from my father was a tradesman, but then he moved into sort of upper management in various positions. But yeah, I'm a massive proponent for trades, for kids getting apprenticeships. School is not for everyone. The classroom, especially for boys, like I spent probably the better part of my teaching career thus far in boys' education. And boys, they're wired differently. They need to move around. They need to touch things. They need to break things. They need to explore the world. Not all. It's a generalization, because there are some who just love just studying and absorbing and academia and that style of learning, rather than just the tactile, let's pull something apart and put it back together and let's see how it works. But I think it's not so much an issue with the students, because they're happy to move on. They want to get jobs. But I think it's currently, it's a mentality with some parents where they go, no, you've got to finish school. You've got to go to university. That's how you're going to be successful. But the world has shifted a great deal. So, yeah. And I'm all about skills.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, Phil, What does your life look like now? Like, I mean, we'll talk a little bit in a moment about some of the, I mean, I have so many questions about artificial intelligence, what it means, and is this the end of civilization as we know it? But what does your sort of day-to-day look like now? Are you in the classroom? Are you somewhat removed from the classroom? What is it? What do you do with your Monday to Friday?
I'm full-time in the classroom. So I sort of, I title myself as, I guess, a specialist design teacher because that's my bread and butter. That's what I've done for, I do a little bit of visual arts and I've taught some engineering, but predominantly it's just design and technology, industrial technology, things like that. So I'm in the classroom. I've had some like assistant heads of department roles and you know, head of a middle school and you know, a head of house for a middle school and things like that. But my day-to-day is teaching, you know, just being in the classroom with the students and trying to equip them with skills, but more so confidence. In the design, like in design technology, especially when we're making stuff, even drawing, like the amount of students who straight up, you give them a pencil and a bit of paper, oh, no, I can't draw. And it's just like, can you write your name? Oh, yeah, I can write my name. I said, so you know how to put lines and curves together to communicate. So you can draw. Nice. You've just got to learn how to put these particular lines and curves together to communicate an object or your idea or your thought process.
Yeah.
And it's building that those skills and that confidence in the student that unfortunately, to a better part, has almost been knocked out of them because of the rigor and the requirements of, it has to be like this and it has to be like that. And you've got to color in the lines and the tree, top of the tree needs to be green and the trunk needs to be brown. It's like, well, why can't it be purple and blue? You know?
Yeah.
So
do you think, and this is a very big question, but do you think creativity is a skill that can be taught? And the reason why I ask that is I've spent a huge component of my career working in kindergarten classrooms and, kids seem to be pretty creative when they come to school. I just had my daughter, she's 4, playing for hours on the floor with Lego, rediscovering this amazing tool, and my 6-year-old just sitting and laughing and building these wonderful creations. No one had to teach them to do that, but it does seem in many ways that we educate children out of that creative process as they move through high school. I mean, would you agree? Would you, what contribution?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think we're humans are innately creative. We love to, you know, you look at architecture, you look at parklands, you look at computers, you look at anything. Like, people want to create stuff. They want to make things. They want to just imprint something. And I think school, to a certain extent, does untrain that creative thinking, and it creates it where you have to follow the rules, and look, rules, there's rules there, in mathematics, in English, in science, there are rules and there are laws and there things have to be done a certain way, but then that's sort of pushed across, and that's made the center focus of the, you know, of what education is. And so, and then, you know, the creative arts and music and design and painting and dance and drama are almost secondary to math, English and science. And so they see that as lesser, so therefore they don't put as much energy into it. And therefore the creativity is lost.
Yeah, I definitely feel there is a hierarchy that's placed around subjects. Like, I think with our maths, and not that I agree with this in any way, but our maths and our English and our science at the top. Unfortunately, your PE, your PD, your design technology, your languages, your dance, drama, creative arts, all of that stuff, not all of that, those subjects seem to be somewhere down the chain. And it's funny because in life, things don't exist in isolation. Like, it's really like, I was having a conversation with a hero of mine, Professor Joe Bowler, a little while ago, and talking about the the creativity and the wonder and the awe and the beauty in mathematics. And I remember feeling so, so ripped off, because I thought, where was this maths when I was at school? Where was this useful mathematics that I could design buildings and calculate area and volume and do all these amazing things? Where was this? And I think about how many students are sitting in our classrooms now that go, I didn't even know I was great at design or drawing, or I didn't even know that maths could be enjoyable or useful. I was always told that the answer was in the back of the book and don't look. I actually felt a bit annoyed, because I thought of all of the opportunities that I'd missed because of the view of the subject, the way the subject had been presented to me in high school. And I don't know, there's not really a question in that, more of a frustration that, I don't know. I don't even know where I was going with that. But
No, I get that. I mean, an example, a prime example of that, it just happened in either the tail end of last term or right at the beginning of this term. We're doing an engineering project where they're building a trebuchet. So senior students, so they had to work out, you know, all the engineering principles for it. And a couple of the boys were trying to build the structure itself, and they couldn't pick an angle. And I said, guys, you do math, yeah? And you've covered trigonometry, yeah? I said, well, what level are you doing now? And they said specialist math. So one of the higher levels of math up here. I said, well, work it out. Work out what you need. And they quickly got their, you know, they got a couple. I said, because you only need two measurements to come up with your triangle. And they've quickly drawn it down, and then they've got the answer. And then they've looked at their work, and then they looked at me, and just this, their eyes just lit up.
Wow.
And it was just like, so it does mean something. It can actually impact life. I said, exactly. I said, So what you're doing is just putting all that theory you're applying that theory in something that is real and relevant and you can understand.
Yeah. And it seems like you're doing exactly the same thing that you talked about, that those mentors did to you in the tool room, how just allowing students enough struggle, but being there to help them and making sure that they don't destroy or damage anything. But I could imagine that would be a skill. I know I struggle with that, because I don't like to see kids struggling through problems and getting frustrated. But it also builds that resilience. Is that something that you try to do, especially in the space that you work in, is just allow the students enough productive struggle to be able to solve these problems?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
hard to do.
It's really hard to do, because you want them to succeed, but sometimes succeeding means failing, and failure in design or in product design or in things like that, or in your trebuchet just not throwing the squash ball as far as you want it to. Whilst it may not achieve what you wanted, you've still learned. So you've not failed. You may have not achieved the outcome you desired, but you've still learned through the process and learned through the pain. As an example, I mean, we look at sports stars. They to get to the elite level, they have to train and they have to work hard. They go to the gym, and after a gym session, they hurt because their muscle is torn and they're aching. But without that pain and without that things breaking, they can't be rebuilt and they can't get stronger to then get better at what they're doing. So,
yeah, absolutely. Phil, what on earth is artificial intelligence, and should I be worried?
Artificial intelligence, like it's a tricky thing, because it depends if you're talking about artificial intelligence or generative artificial intelligence, or then there's machine learning, and then there's a whole range of things. Now, artificial intelligence has been around with us. The term was coined back in the 50s. So it's not anything new. Generative artificial intelligence, like ChatGPT and Claude and Gemini and Midjourney and the like, they're relatively new. It's an amazing piece of technology. It's fun, and it's creative. It's you know, we were talking about math earlier, and you know, one of your mentors and heroes was, you know, just expounding the joys of math. And that's what generative and artificial intelligence is. It's math just doing work for us in a creative way. Should we be worried? It's a two-sided coin. There's a definite yes, we should be worried, but no, we shouldn't. I'm an optimist. I like, I'm cynical with certain things, but overall, I have an optimistic view. And artificial intelligence has a huge, it has the opportunity to make our lives more human.
Yeah.
To be able to connect us on new and exciting levels. For me in education, I look at what it can do to help me enhance the experience of my students in the classroom.
Mm. Yeah.
And that doesn't mean using it in, I don't use it in every lesson. I don't use it a lot in my classroom. I use it a little bit here and there. We've got to be careful because there are a lot of issues surrounding it. There are user agreements, and there's privacy, and there's ethical implications, and there's thorough, yeah, they've got to understand it. But I use it a lot outside of the classroom to help me be creative, to iterate, to work through solutions, to come up with ideas on a one-on-one that I couldn't think of on my own.
Yeah.
Should we be worried about it? Look, there's nefarious players in everything. I mean, the big knee-jerk reaction was plagiarism, but I mean, anyone older than, you know, about 30 knows that the Encyclopedia Britannica was the best thing to plagiarize from. You know, you'd go down and copy that out of the library. And then came the internet, and that just made it a little bit easier. And then generative artificial intelligence, again, has just made it a little bit easier. People who will use things to cut corners will always do that, regardless of what's made available. I think the bigger implications are probably yet to be determined, but we've seen things where, you know, especially in political climates, predominantly the US at the moment, that's probably the biggest thing, with deep fakes with political figures, the ability to generate someone's voice, you or I, once this podcast goes live, anyone can, I mean, your voices will be very easily manipulated. They don't need about 30 seconds of it, and Matt Green will be everywhere. But we just need to teach these the children and the students about the implications of it, like we're seeing now the implications of social media all too late. But if we teach them how to use this effectively and for the right reasons, it's going to have a great impact in their lives.
Yeah. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the work of Professor Ethan Mollick from the US. I'm very nervous. He's coming on for a chat in the coming weeks, and he talks a lot about LLMs, so large language models, and sort of the implications for artificial intelligence and LLMs. And just because I should probably do a little bit of homework before I interview Ethan, are you able to unpack what an LLM is, and what are some of the impacts you think that AI will have in that space?
So the LLM is the large language model. So that's ChatGPT, Claude, Gemini. So that's a huge, it's a huge model that has millions of tokens of data that's just sitting in there. And what we use, what we see on our screens, is just the tip of the mountain. Everything is the foundational information. Ethan Mollick, I mean, some of his works, it just goes well beyond my scope. But it has those implications. It's how we use it. It's how it's, there's the easy stuff that we can use, and it's great for educators to help us produce large amounts of work, because the corpus of information that, rightly or wrongly, these companies have scraped and got books and all sorts of stuff. That's a whole other podcast. It's there, and that'll help us bring up information. Like, to create, like, as an example, beginning of the year, I had to build up a new project to create lesson planners, outlines, so everything that's required for registration and things like that. Would normally take, you know, maybe 3 to 4 hours to produce. We're using the large language model with the right inputs. It created all the work I needed in probably about 10 minutes. And then I edited for half an hour. And then I had my, you know, within the space of an hour, I managed to save 3 hours of brain, you know, painstaking work. But with that, it allows me to repurpose my time back into my creativity, into my classroom.
So how do you think the role of the teacher is changing then? Because I would definitely argue that your time is better spent in a classroom working with kids and supporting them than it is sitting in front of computer writing programs.
100%.
How do you think that is going to change the educational landscape for, let's just start with teachers and then move on to students, but how is it going to change the game for us educators? Or how is it?
It's starting to look. There's sort of, you know, you split teachers up into thirds currently with the way they think about artificial intelligence. Some are, yep, I'm on it, I'm using it, it's fantastic. Others are, yeah, okay, I've seen it, I've played with it, that's okay. And then another third are sort of like, nah, I'm not touching that. I'm not going to have a bar of it at all. And that's okay. Teachers have been, in my, you know, this is just, again, my view, teachers have been beat up by edtech companies. We've been bashed around with, here, try this new shiny thing. It'll make your life so much easier. And you spend all this time trying to work out how to use it, and then it doesn't work. Or the school spends a tremendous amount of money on it, and no one uses it because it's just ineffective in the classroom.
Yeah.
So I understand a lot of teachers' hesitancy about artificial intelligence, especially in the world of education, because it's like we are so stressed and so time poor and overloaded. It's like, I can't learn something new. I've got everything. It works. I can do my classes. I don't want to have to worry about it. So.
Do you think this is different, though?
I do, and that's why I'm...
It doesn't seem to be like another thing that we're adopting. It seems to be something, and we always talk about these new things that are going to change the game, but this actually seems like it will.
Yeah, and look, and that's why I've invested so much of my time into it, because I saw it, I heard about it in its very, very early stages, but I was like, okay, I'll just leave that to the side. That's for the computer science guys and all that sort of stuff. But it was starting to bleed into more and more conversation. And I thought, I'm going to start looking into this. And like through all my industries, through industry, through teaching, I've always tried to future-proof myself, and I like to learn. I put up a post a little while ago on LinkedIn, which again a little bit of controversy, which is always good, but it sparked conversation. But it was like I love to learn, but I don't like to study. I'm learning. I'm looking into things. I'm reading, but it's not a drudgery for me anyway. But I think it will, and it is changing education. I mean, we've been using AI in education for quite a while now. You know, everyone's told to use Grammarly, use spell check in Word, and you know, various things like that. So it's been in our realm for quite a while. This is just a new way, a creative way of doing things. And I understand the hesitancy and the fear that it'll stop people, you know, stop students thinking. That's another big one. But to actually get a really good output, you need to put a really good input in. So you need to be able to craft a question. And I mean, teachers are great at questioning. We're great at extracting knowledge from students. We're great at, if we don't get what we think, or if we don't get the right answer, or we don't get the information from the student that we know that they have, we rephrase the question, we ask again, and we probe, and we prod, and we pry. And that's what we just do with these large language models. Mm. And that's how I use it. I use it as like I said, a creative tool and to do some of the grunt work for me. But I talk to it like I talk to a colleague in a very conversational way. And that seems to give me quite a good response.
So what are change always seems to be a bit of a double-edged sword though, doesn't it? There's always your pros and then there's always some things that you need to watch. I mean, what are some of those things that we need to consider in order to use large language models and AI in a way that is sustainable?
We need to ask the why.
Yeah.
Like, why are we using it? Why do we need our students to use it? Do we just need to use it because we think everyone else is using it? And the answer is no, we don't need to use it. We need to teach the students critical thinking skills. We need to teach them empathy and understanding and relationship and human connection. But it helps them. The you know, a great example, and it's out of my teaching area, like, so it's in English, but a great example is when a student has a blank page, they're stuck on how do I write this whatever it is. And so they can ask, you know, they can go, oh look, I'm a year 12 student, I'm struggling to write an essay on such and such. This is my topic area. Can you give me some pointers of where I might be able to start? And you're not asking it to write the assignment for you. You're not asking, you're just going, I'm struggling with it. It's like they would talk to a teacher, but you know, it's 2 a.m. because it's year 12 and it's due the next day. So they're asking the teacher, like, they're just asking this, like, where can I start? And so it might give them a whole range of, oh, you could try this, you could try this. But what that does is quite often it'll give a number of quite good responses, but it'll get the student thinking, oh no, hold on, I actually want to go in this direction. So it's answering the question, but guiding them to their own thought process so that they can get it started.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I use it, I'm using it more and more, but I use it a lot for article ideas and ways to structure articles for my website, and it's really useful. And I view ChatGPT, and I'm very much very, very much a novice on that, but I actually like it. I love that. I love that. I'm just trying to work it out. But it's great. I feel like I've got a teacher with me all of the time, whether on my phone or my desktop, and it's been wonderful.
Yeah, and that's what I find. Like, it's that colleague that will always answer your question, is never bored, isn't distracted, hasn't has to go for the next class, and you can just continually ask it questions, and it'll give you it'll just continually talk to you without being tired. So yeah, and that's where I use it. It's like, you know, in design we need to be creative, and I've got a fair few ideas, but it just goes, oh, how can I modify this? How can I adjust this? And it throws me down that path. So it helps me give more autonomy in a way.
Yeah. So we've talked about, I mean, ChatGPT seems to be the product that everyone's raving about. But are there some other ones, some other AI tools that teachers can use in their classroom to really kind of help drive that learning?
Oh, there is about a bajillion. that are out there. It comes down to personal preference.
Right.
And there's Gemini, which is the Google one. There's Claude, which is by Anthropic. There's another great conversational one called Pi. It's very Socratic. So you type in and it's just asking you questions to help you work out where you want to go. So it's a great conversational bot. There's some great like all the Adobe suite now has generative stuff in there, which is great for students because it has quite a few guardrails up there. So it's not going to be able to produce things that are well outside of what you actually want students to be doing. Yeah. But it all comes with there are pitfalls with that. There are, you know, you would have read articles and heard people talking about, you know, various inherent biases and things that pop up, especially with image generation. So there's something to be, we need to make the students aware of that, talk them through it and explain. Bias is not necessarily a bad thing, but it does have some negative implications.
But also, like, I mean, I'm not sure if you're aware of there's a we look at textual concepts in English and the idea that you can actually like the idea of perspective. So like how you view something, we think it's perfectly normal to see the world through a particular way. But it's not until you get the opinions of others and realize that there's an inherent bias in everything, in news and articles and books, there's a lens through which we see the world. And it seems to me like these inherent biases in many of the ChatGPT programs is actually a really great discussion point for kids to say, hey, like, this is a really good opportunity for you to be able to read critically and read widely. And I don't know about you, but I'm looking at the world at the moment and I think more people need to be able to critically evaluate sources and form their own opinions. And so I think it could be a really important discussion point for kids.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And it's a great place to start. It's like, you know, asking them what, you know, you can create some like Google actually has just taken their image generation off currently because there was a few things that were floating around the internet where they asked them to produce some images of certain historical figures or time periods, and it was completely inaccurate or very off color, you know, and many would say very offensive, for some of the images that they produced. So there's, and that comes down to programming and coding and these things being, and I mean, AI currently, the generative AI is probably, you know, as dumb as it's ever going to be at the moment, and it's only going to get better. Like it's in its infantile stages with what it's doing in this iteration, and it's only improving.
So it seems like you are quite on the pulse in terms of what's happening in the AI space. For someone that wants to try and, for those that are listening that want to just try and find a little bit more out about what's going on and also stay up to date, are there any great great thinkers or great researchers or blogs that you would kind of recommend checking out? Because it seems like a very complicated space. Is there anyone that you kind of go to, this person knows what he's talking about?
There's a few educators on and people on LinkedIn that I follow. We mentioned Leon Furs earlier, Ethan Mollick, Stefan Bouchard, Darren Coxon, Dr. Nick Jackson down in South Australia. There's a guy by the name, he's become, you know, becoming quite a good friend of mine now, Phil Alcock, who is very much with artificial intelligence and project-based learning. He's based in Acapulco. But there's a lot of stuff out there, and what I would say is just if you come to also trialing stuff, like don't pay for anything, don't subscribe to anything. Try different things first, just to see what fits, because they all have their own personality and they all have strengths and weaknesses.
I'll make sure, Phil, that I put all of the links to those people in our show notes so people can check them out. But if you have any kind of recommended resources, please email them through and I'll make sure that they get distributed to the listeners of the podcast. But I remember interviewing Dr. Nick Jackson, and he, I believe it was the night before he was about to get his PhD. I think he'd already been given it, but he was actually at the ceremony. And I remember him just talking through this whole emotional process of what it was like to begin a PhD and finally be done. And he was just an incredible, incredible guest and really so generous. And some of the questions that he was asking and some of the research that he was doing in that AI space was, it was beyond me, but really, really interesting. He's a fascinating person.
Yeah, he's been fantastic. We've had quite a few conversations through LinkedIn. We've had one Zoom meeting, which was great. But yeah, his ability to think through things and the lens that he looks through, is just it's been really beneficial for me, coming from that. So which yeah, so I couldn't recommend for even though he is from Leeds, I couldn't recommend him for an Australian contact more highly. Him and Leo, him and Leon, so.
And both of them, Leon as well, like I said, are both really generous. And as I mentioned before we hit record, I'm continually amazed by the generosity of our profession and the fact that you can call someone like Leon or you can call someone like Nick, and they will actually return your phone call or they will actually get back to your email. And I think no matter how busy I think I am, I always have time to help serve and to help invest back into our wonderful profession because we really are a generous bunch. I think it's really wonderful.
I think to our own detriment, at times as well.
I agree.
I mean, I could spout off probably, 100 names, to put on your show notes, but yeah, there's so many teachers. There's so many high quality teachers out there who just want the best for other teachers and for their students, and that's what I really appreciate. And I've been in the game for quite a while now, so.
So Phil, I want to be respectful of your time. I'm aware that I'm about to ask you a question about balance, and it's almost 9 o'clock my side of the world and 8 o'clock yours up in Queensland. But what have you learned about prioritizing your own mental health and teaching? Because there's a lot of people that leave. So how have you kind of sustained yourself for such a lengthy and also diverse career?
I tend not to like the word balance when it comes to that, because you think about balance, I mean, you're there, you're working hard to try and stay stable, and if you lose your balance, something's going to break, something's going to fall, something's going to drop. So I look at it through the lens of prioritizing, and unfortunately with prioritizing, sometimes things have to get put to the side. Sometimes that's your family, sometimes it's work, sometimes it's both, to look after yourself. But it's over the years I've learned that work will always be there. Work will continue to go on. Unfortunately, through my teaching career, I've had a tremendous amount of highs. I've worked hard, and so we should. But I've also had tremendous tragedy, through life, like so many people. I had a quite a traumatic motorcycle accident, just after I started I was about 4 days into a new job at Sydney Grammar. And I had a motorcycle accident, which put me off work for about a term. But with that came
It's not a good start, is it?
no, it wasn't the best, but they were fantastic. The school were great. I was very supportive. But again, in that circumstance, the school still went on. Even though I wasn't there, the school still kept on going.
It's humbling, isn't it? Because as important as we think we are, and we do a really significant job, it will still go on. And
Yeah.
it's a good reminder, isn't it, to hold those two things in tension.
And from that helped sort of, I guess, you know, being the typical Aussie bloke, it put mortality front and center. And I realized that I wasn't immortal as much as I, you know, I think we think we are. So I had the physical recovery, but then there was a lot of mental trauma from that. With anxiety and post-traumatic stress. I had essentially two breakdowns. And thank goodness for a tremendously supportive family. My wife and my children just loved and cared and nurtured and put up with a whole bunch of stuff that they shouldn't have had to, but that's unfortunately that's life. Met the medical profession, seeing medical professionals, and like I'm not ashamed to say, and I don't think we should ever be, that I saw psychiatrists and psychologists, and I was on antidepressants for a long time. Like if we get sick, if we get a cough, or we get an infection, we're not afraid to go, oh yeah, I'm on antibiotics. But if we're struggling through mental trauma for whatever reason, mine was a motorcycle accident, something could be a childhood trauma, something could be a loved one dying unexpectedly. But don't try and do it alone. Seek help, seek advice, use medication if needed. But they're some of the things that I've got through, that I've had to prioritize myself over work. I've had to prioritize myself over family, because if I can't care for myself and I can't look after myself, then I'm useless to anyone. But it's about just working at and look, we make a decision and we just got to roll with it sometimes. And I think I was listening to one of your podcasts, and it was someone mentioned, I'm not sure if it was you or your guest, that mentioned the 10-10-10 sort of thing, like 10 minute, you know, how are you going to feel in 10 minutes, 10 months, 10 years?
Yeah.
And you know, so, you know, you look at that sort of decision, like, yep, I've made a wrong decision. How much is it going to impact, or how much can I change, or am I even going to be thinking about it in 10 minutes?
That's great.
But yeah, it's I tend to look at priority rather than balance.
I think that's really important, and thank you so much, Phil, for sharing such a raw and honest part of your life. And my hope is that there will be people out there that will listen to this and go, you know what? Yeah, it's okay to have these conversations, and I'm really grateful that for your bravery to be able to do that. I think it's really important. And also, I think to have these honest conversations around teaching are really important, because it is one of those jobs, I think, that if you're not careful, it can take over your life. And because you're right, it never ends. There's always something. But I think I've definitely learned over these last couple of years. I'm in the leadership position now, which is a whole nother level of wonderful complexity. But you actually have to take time out and retreat sometimes and just sit. And the last couple of years has been particularly challenging in our family, and kind of caught up with me a couple of years ago. And it's a reminder that we're not as invincible as we think we are, and we need to take care of ourselves. And Phil, it's been a real privilege to get to chat to you this evening. I've been a fan of your work forever, and it's been lovely to finally connect and just hear your heart and hear your passion for educators and students. It's been really wonderful. And just before we wrap up, a final question. If I was sitting down with you and I had just bought you a small flat white, and I was just about to step into the classroom for the first time, what short piece of advice would you give me about how to love my job in 10, 20, 30 years time?
Biggest thing is just breathe. Step back, take a breath. Don't put too much pressure on yourself. Like you are not going to be the best when you start. You're learning your craft. I've got a real, you know, as you know, I've been teaching for so long, I'm getting more and more of a heart for how can I help younger teachers stay in the career, stay in the profession that they've chosen, that they wanted to do. And it's just like, just breathe, close your laptop at the end of the day. Like, you know, I don't have work on my personal phone. I only have one mobile phone. I don't have alerts because I know I'm going to check it. If it dings, that dopamine hit's going to be there and I'm going to check it. So I don't have work stuff on my phone. When I leave work, I close my laptop, and with the exception of going, you know, chatting with certain people, it stays closed all night.
Yeah, really good.
And that's what I would say. It's just like, it will be there tomorrow. But just make sure that you are.
That's great advice. Phil, it's been a real privilege and a pleasure to get to connect with you tonight. And thank you. Thank you so much for your time, and thank you for everything that you're investing into our profession. I really do appreciate it. Thank you so much.
No, thank you, Matt. I appreciate your time. And yeah, it's been great to have a conversation.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to the podcast episode today. It's a privilege to get to share these conversations with you and continue to invest into our incredible profession. If you have a few moments, please do me a favor and leave a review on iTunes, Spotify, or through whichever platform you're listening today. If you wouldn't mind also hitting the subscribe button and sharing it with your networks, it would really help to get the word out to as many educators as possible. There are different ways to connect in the notes below, including links to the website, the Facebook group, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you again for taking the time to listen. It means the world.